The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com. Matt, wanted to ask you about that survey, that story I was telling you from Forbes Advisors saying that Oregon's drivers are number two in the country. It just doesn't ring true to me. I'm not trying to make excuses for us, but I don't know. What do you think?
I've lived here almost 31 years. I grew up driving the freeways of Southern California. I've driven in the biggest cities in the country.
Uh-huh.
There is no way that we could be the second worst drivers. Now, you made a point. It could be that we're more casual drivers.
Yes.
Right?
That it's a very casual society in many ways in Oregon.
Yeah, like when the light turns green, we don't just put our foot through the floor praying to God that the people, you know, whose light just turned red aren't going to try to fly through the light like they do in the San Fernando Valley.
Right.
But there is no way. You're 100% right. If these people, they must have just grabbed stats or something and came up with some bend on it. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, because driving through Pittsburgh, driving in New York City, driving through Chicago. I mean, you know, it's like Mad Max in some ways. In fact, incredibly aggressive. And, for a West Coaster, someone who's become more of a West Coaster than he ever was an East Coaster, kind of terrifying.
I remember being in the back of a cab with a Filipino cab driver in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And he was driving, and there it's a car lane, but it looked no wider than a bicycle lane. He's driving, no clutch. He's got 1 foot on the gas, 1 foot on the brake, and his left hand on the horn while the right hand steers.
And that's normal.
That's normal.
Yeah.
There's no way that is safer than the way the good people of Oregon drive.
Yeah.
No
and way. We'll just leave it at that, Matt. Thanks for the call, all right? 11 minutes after 8. We're going to talk with David Tereshuk. He's the author of A Question of Paternity. Interesting story about he spent so much of his life just trying to find dad. And what happened after that? This hour of my show is sponsored by Fontana Roofing for roofing, gutters, and sheet metals.
Off now, PrivacyKim.com.
Hear KMED in Grants Pass on 105.9 K290 AF Rogue River in South Jackson County on 106.7 K294 AS Ashland.
Proud to talk with David Tereshuk. He is an interesting guy, a PBS television reporter. Been there for quite some time. And he brought out a memoir, A Question of Paternity. And David, it's great to have you on. Good morning. And you're in New York right now, correct?
Yes, I am, Bill. I'm very grateful to you for having me on your show. But I should make one word of warning. I'm in New York, you're right. This is my New York base. And it's UN week, the opening of the General Assembly. So you may hear us being interrupted by helicopters going overhead and New York City police motorcades with their sirens going. We'll do our best, though. I'll try my best to talk over it.
Hey, we appreciate that. At least letting us know, David, if I hear the siren, I know you're not being hauled off or anything. Okay, so hey,
they're not coming for me.
Yeah. In all seriousness, though, hey, since you have been famed TV reporter for so many years here, if you don't mind me asking, of all the people, are there any? What are some of the most special people you think that you've talked to over the years before we get into your book? And what was that like? Because, sometimes sometimes it's a challenge, and not being awed is probably important as a reporter, I would imagine. Not being too much in awe of someone.
Well, sure. It's a really hard question to answer because I've been doing it for so many years with British TV networks and then latterly with American networks, ending up about 10 years ago with PBS. But I suppose there's one particular figure who stands out for me because he was so important to all my work, really. For something like 40 years, I charted very carefully, very dedicatedly, the liberation struggle in South Africa. 300 years of white minority rule oppressing that country. And eventually in 1994, Nelson Mandela, the leader of the African National Congress, the main liberation organization, had been released from prison and he ran for president. And eventually he became the first black president of a free, democratic, South Africa, and I was out to get him, as it were. But the big American commercial networks had him sort of tied up. So it was the day before the election, and they had these set-piece interviews arranged with him in a particular discreet room in a major hotel in Johannesburg, South Africa. So I knew the hotel very well from staying there over many decades. And I charted what his path would be to this discreet room. And basically, I ambushed him.
Okay.
Much to the surprise and annoyance of his two security guys. But he sort of waved them away and let me conduct what was a very short interview, but my goodness, a very memorable one for me. Not in terms of what was actually said and what I got on the record. It was kind of commonplace, really. It was the day before an election, and he said all the things that you'd expect a politician to say the day before an election. But I had this thought running through my mind. I sort of lost my train of thought, because inwardly, all I could think was, hey, here I am with Nelson Mandela in the kitchen, because that's where I was, surrounded by these industrial-sized sacks of flour and cans of tomato paste. It was just astonishing, really. And he was graceful and gracious. He drew the interview to a close pretty quickly and walked on for his appointment with ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Well, good for you.
I had my moment.
Yeah, well, good for your ambushing skills, if nothing else here, David. Now, you know, it's interesting. There was so much promise, I think, you know, with Mandela coming to power and all this other issues with the removal of oppressive rule. But have you ever felt concerned about what's happened to South Africa ever since, in which it seems like now it's just oppressed by a different race now? And now it's like, let's kill the Boer farmer and things like that, and a lot of Boer farmer.
Government, they say that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. There's a great deal lacking in terms of observance of the law in South Africa nowadays. Mm-hmm. And people in power end up not listening as closely as they used to do to the people they represent. And I'm afraid that's a feature not unique to South Africa. You see it all over the world. And it's sad. African National Congress in many ways has lost its way. One of its stalwart mouthpieces. Well, not really a mouthpiece. He was always a very independent guy. But Archbishop Desmond Tutu was very much allied with the African National Congress. And right up until he died a couple of years ago, or two or three years ago now, he was expressing great concern about the way that the African National Congress had gotten used to power. And in many ways, in many places, it was abusing it.
In some ways, becoming what you fought against or what you hated, that kind of thing?
Well, that's in many cases, they employed laws that were hangovers from the previous oppressive rule that the white Boers, as you call them, would employ. And many of the same techniques. It's very regrettable. And I think, you know, now with a change of government, change of president more recently, the worst of the ANC presidents who followed Mandela, Jacob Zuma, is now off the scene, or at least very much diminished. He was persuaded to step away from the top position. And the present president is a man of stronger substance, I think. I think we should be more hopeful now.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that, because what I've been reading about some people who have escaped South Africa has not been real pleasant. But thanks for the update here. I want to talk about your memoir, though. And of course, you didn't come from South Africa. You actually came from the Scottish borderlands and had a very interesting background. And were you born during World War II, or was it shortly thereafter? And your book is called, and it's a memoir, A Question of Paternity, My Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. And it seems like your origins, I sense, have had just an incredible impact on you most of your life about trying to find who your father was, right? To tell us a little bit about that.
That's true. I was born after the war, after the war, 3 years after the war in 1948. And it was a rural community, not metropolitan. My mother was only 15 years old when I was conceived and 16 years old when I was born. We were a poor family. We lived in public housing, a small tract of municipally owned small houses, and my family was a unit presided over by my grandmother, and it was such a scandal when her 15-year-old daughter got pregnant that...
That was a big deal in those days, David. That was huge.
Well, exactly. My point is that it's a long time ago in a very rural area, and attitudes were a long way different from what they are now to children being born out of wedlock. And a cover story was invented for me. First of all, my mother had to go out to work and stop being a high school girl anymore. She had to end her education and go out and become the family's only breadwinner, because my grandmother felt that I was one mouth more, too many mouths more
to feed
with
yeah.
me. Because she had other children in the house too. There were two uncles of mine who I thought were my brothers. Because this was the other aspect of the cover up. This is something that I find hard to believe as I look back. But you know, it was just how it was. I was supposed to be. I was passed off as my grandmother's child.
She was in her 50s, right?
Absolutely. I don't know how they thought they'd get away with this, but that was the story.
Uh-huh.
And I called my grandmother Mam, the Scots word for mom, and I called my sister Hilda, which is her first name, and always did, right up until she died. The two little boys who were in the house, they were definitely my playmates. I thought they were my brothers. They were, in fact, my uncle. And it's a very uncertain cloud of mystery about my upbringing sort of got instilled in me, I think. I internalized the notion, it was made clear to me somehow. I don't remember being told this out loud any time, but it was a subject that I should never bring up and never address. So I never did. For the longest time, I went, you know, I grew up, my mother married, we moved, I had a stepfather, I ended up going to college. And all the time, I told myself it didn't matter to me who my real father was. But that changed.
What did change it when all of a sudden this became like almost a single focus of your life for so many years, trying to find out who the identity of your father? This turned into a huge life quest, really.
It was a focus, yeah, and a very determined focus. But I mean, I carried on with my regular job as well. I was very dedicated to my profession. But yes, I embarked upon a search because I think I had gotten to the point I was just sick of the secrecy. I just wanted a clean slate, and I wanted a way of getting along with my mother, which was not clouded by this big secret that hung between us. I'd avoided it because I thought it would upset her. I thought all sorts of things as good rationalizations for not approaching the topic. But eventually, they ceased to have the weight that they had. I wanted an open and honest way of living, and that meant getting rid of secrets.
So there were a couple of stories or a couple of theories that ended up happening. One of them was that I think, if I recall correctly, I'm still reading the book. I only got it just a few days ago. And it was one of the theories was that there was a priest coming through town and took a liking to your mother, if I recall. And then one thing led to another. And then there was another one in which that that she was raped by a priest, and that's what my mother
eventually told me.
That's what she told you.
I had of my conception. She told me that when she was 15, she went to a Catholic mass with her Catholic friend. We were not Catholics. There were very few Catholics in that part of the country. The family that she was friendly with were Italian immigrants and therefore Catholic, of course.
Sure.
And she went with her high school friend just to see what a mass was like. And her account is that the priest took a liking to her, walked her home after the mass service, and then dragged her into a neighbor's garden and raped her there. And that was a stunning story for me to hear in my 40s. That's when it finally came from my mother to me. And we talked about it then, and then she never talked to me about it again. And I never really got the chance to cross-question her and perhaps do the kind of journalistic probing that I would normally do. It turns out that your mother one's mother is not just another interview, if it's your own mother, I mean.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I never got to cross-question her, but I cross-questioned the evidence. I did an awful lot of research into the church and its employees of the period. And, of course, was very leery about the church's record at covering up such scandals. We know that there's been lots of terrible exposés of priests abusing children.
Well, hey, I was raised a Catholic, and I know the stories about what would happen if something went wrong, that quite often the priest would be relocated to a different parish.
Absolutely, and we were on the track of a priest who actually was moved from the parish that would have provided the priest for this local mass, and we thought we were on the track of a prime suspect. He was moved away from our village area the very same month that I was born, and then reappeared in diocese's records about 2 years later under a slightly changed name, so it wasn't quite so easy to find him. But then that turned out to be a dud lead, because although we tracked him down historically, to the point where he died, some distance away, but still in the same diocese. But it turns out, through the modern miracle of DNA, we were able to establish, because DNA had been placed in one of these genealogy websites by a very close relative to this priest, that there was no connection with me genetically whatever.
Ah, okay, so that ended up being a draw. That didn't go anywhere, and so then I guess you start turning to Germany, right? That's where you end up.
Well, I did. That's right, Bill, because of DNA. I was my DNA was being compared with the databases of people who join these genealogical DNA-based websites and communities. I was in the memory base, if you like, of 11 of these organizations, like Ancestry.com, 23andMe, MyHeritage.com, all those. So I was my DNA was being compared with about 11 to 12 million individuals, and matches started to come up. Not close matches, but close enough to be, say, a second cousin or a third cousin. So we obviously must have had common ancestors at some point, maybe at the great-great-grandfather remove. And they were all popping up in Germany, and they had German names and were German nationals. So that started a whole new line of inquiry. And one of the important things you said right at the very beginning, and you're right, that I was brought up in sort of wartime. There was still, even 3 years after the Second World War ended, a prisoner of war camp for German prisoners of war on the outskirts of our village. So that led us, of course, to look at that as a possible source for the man who fathered me, in one sense of the word, anyway.
Were you able, like I said, I have not been able to finish it, but were you ever able to get closure or get to the final bottom, or was there just no way to really zoom in? You could find distant relatives, but you could never find the relative, David? Can you comment on that? I don't know.
That's a good summary of how it went, Bill. You really have to read the book.
Yeah, well, I'm still doing it. I'm going to finish it this weekend, I assure you, okay?
Well, you'll find that my search goes on and gets very more complicated and in some ways more frustrating because, to be perfectly honest, this is not really giving anything away. I don't, in the end, have a totally conclusive ironclad truth as an answer. I've got lots of hints, lots of suggestions, lots of very strong hints, but nothing that definitely identifies a particular individual. It's been a journey.
You know, David, you were quite open about your alcoholism all through this this period. You're quite, like I said, you're open book, no pun intended. you know, on this particular issue. Was it the not knowing the whole story, or maybe the aspect of secrecy, you know, about parentage and such that may have brought some of that to bear? I don't know. I just thought I'd at least ask.
I don't know for sure either, Bill, but I know that, I mean, I think alcoholics are made. They're born, I think. Mm. They're not made by circumstance. I think there has to be a genetic connection. And I know on my mother's, the only family I know about, of course, is my mother's side. And there is a strain of alcoholism in that family. My grandfather, who I never knew because he died leaving my grandmother a widow when she was rearing me, he died long before, eight years or so before I was born. He was an acknowledged alcoholic, at least acknowledged by other people. You know, the chances were that I could become an alcoholic just because of the genetic makeup I had. Mm. But I can't help feeling that the whole idea of not knowing whose I was contributed to a sense of not knowing who I was. And I was a very shy, reserved kid and inwardly looking and very unsure of himself, very ill at ease with other people. So when alcohol came into my life, and I found it very early, about the age of 13, it was a benefit for me, and it helped me get over my fear of the outside world. And, you know, what I didn't know, of course, that I was a prime candidate for addiction. My addiction was triggered, and we all know it's a progressive disease, and it got worse and worse and worse.
And hey, David, let's be honest, though, when it comes to your career choice, being a journalist in there, I mean, that's kind of, you know, back in those days, that was almost a prerequisite to be a hard drinker, wasn't it?
You have a point. I had very good cover. Shall we put it that way?
Yeah.
I was not alone in my heavy drinking. That's true. But you know, the defining thing about an alcoholic is that it comes eventually to determine your life. There were very heavy drinkers around me in the various newsrooms I worked in. But they were able to stop at times, and
you weren't able to.
Necessarily all alcoholics.
Yeah,
I was totally unable to do so until I reached the point where I just had to. You know, I was beaten, and in the end, I surrendered.
Glad to hear that, David Tarashuk, once again, and his book. It's an interesting memoir. It's called A Question of Paternity. And like I said, you talk about your career in there. You also talk about this search for your real father, the frustration that is involved in this. You know, who is David? You know, how should you relate to the world and such? As far as the journalism side of your life, you know, your craft, you made it clear that you are, you know, that you really did look at it as a craft. What do you believe has happened to the craft of journalism, because it feels so, I don't know. Especially, maybe it's just in the United States it's this way, David. But maybe you could give me. I swear it's being run by 12-year-olds with no institutional memory and with little care for fact. It's about what agenda or what does the editor want that day. Could you give me any comment on that? You know, your feel about the state of journalism today in the world?
The state of the world is the real challenge to journalism, and in America especially, I think. I mean, in many ways, we are the home of we Americans. I'm a naturalized citizen now. We Americans are the originators of the Internet. I mean, certain British scientists would claim otherwise, but clearly the Internet developed dramatically really fast in Silicon Valley and so on, and it very much has changed American society astonishingly. The digital revolution now gives everybody the capacity to be a journalist in a way. We're all our own publishers, too, if we want to be. And the sheer torrent of information that can flow at us, and indeed from us, if we want to be contributors to this deluge. And that makes the role of a journalist very, very important and also extra challenging compared with what it used to be. There's so much material that is often inaccurate, deliberately misleading sometimes, sloshing around in this torrent, that sifting the wheat from the chaff to change my metaphor a bit and use that old phrase is really difficult, but it has to be done. I taught journalism for a while at Columbia Journalism School, and I was there as this whole scene was changing so dramatically, and the burden upon the individual young journalist is extraordinary now. And I want to say more power to their elbow, but I also fear for many of them not being up to the task. Good journalists will always do well, I think, but lazy journalists or journalists who don't have the stick-to-itiveness that is necessary to sort the wheat from the chaff can often let the side down, as it were, and give journalism a bad name, and they do sometimes.
You also talk about the need to actually get out and talk with people, and that seems to be something which is not done so much. I swear so much of the news that gets put out these days is people just kind of watching what's happening online, as if that's real life.
I'm afraid so. I'm afraid that's right. And in my book, that does not count as journalism. I suspect it doesn't for you either. But on the other hand, people can put on a journalistic label and profess to be wearing a journalistic hat. But journalism is is more than just expressing a reaction to events. Journalism is about understanding events, and that means talking to people proactively and getting out of the house for a start. Going to see people will give you a different dimension from watching everything online too.
Yeah, just because you saw it on TikTok does not mean that it was necessarily valid, all right? David, what are you hoping people will take from your memoir? Because like I said, you talk the career, you talk the paternity and the search for that and your own personal experiences. What are you hoping people will grasp from that?
Well, I trust that people, and especially people who might be in a similar, not necessarily the same situation as myself, what I would say is that someone laboring under the burden of a deep secret, a family secret or any other kind of secret. But in a way, family secrets are the worst. If you're carrying that kind of burden, I think it's really important to start asking questions and pursuing questions. Questions are very dear to me. I mean, they're the essential tool of my work life, and of course they became the essential tool for my journey of truth seeking that I went on. And I would say, you know, if secrecy is crippling you, then break it apart. Do your best to get it all in the open.
I would also say ask those family questions while family members are all still around and still alive, because, you know, a lot of times once, you know, we think about getting to this too late, then you're just really too late. You can never really get the story.
Yeah, and I certainly come into that category. I lost a lot of potential witnesses, as it were, in my line of inquiry, simply because I'm old and they were even older, and many of them have died along the way before I could get the full set of answers that I wanted.
David, I like your style. I've enjoyed getting into the book. I want to finish it this weekend, but it's a question of paternity. My life as an unaffiliated reporter, and just published last week. I'll put all the information up, and a pleasure getting to meet you, even over the phone. Okay? Be well.
Same here. Thanks very much, Bill.
Thank you. It is 8:42. This is KMED 99.3 KBXG.
Ben Franklin once said,
give Bill a shout at 541-770-5633. 770-KMED.
And back before I get to the phones, I want to make sure that you know about a meeting coming up on Tuesday. This is going to be 6:30 in the evening. And this is a Medicare update seminar being put on by Lynn Barton. And she's the Medicare advisor at Sky Park Insurance. Now, Sky Park, of course, saving money on regular insurance lines. We've been talking about that for years with Steve Yancey. But what Lynn is putting on is that this is for people who have either a Medicare Advantage or a prescription drug plan. And if you have one of that, Lynn wants you to know that the Inflation Reduction Act could have some good effects for you next year, but it could also really mess things up. And so she wants to make sure that everybody knows about what is going on with this Medicare Update seminar. And so it's Tuesday, 6:30 at the Phoenix Library. Lynn does need you to call her, though, at 541-499-0958, 541-499-0958, or email Lynn, L-Y-N-N, at skyparkins.com, where you can also find her on the Sky Park Insurance website. So remember, Tuesday night, Medicare Update Seminar. Find out either, hey, the good news or how badly you'll be screwed unless you come up with some other alternative, all right? 541-499-0958, okay? All right. 8:46. Chris Barnett running for Josephine County Commission. Chris, what's going on in Josephine County? What are you, a bunch of, like, high school kids all beating each other up and stealing signs? What's going on there in Josephine County? Oh, it's like student council. What's happening?
It is childish, and it's stupid. It's stealing, and I caught a perpetrator. I caught somebody stealing one of my political signs, and it just happened to be by me, Bill. And, you know, my prior experience as a law enforcement officer, I'm like seeing this lady stuck in an intersection. I'm like, what is she doing? I was going to render aid, help her out. And then I see her lifting something out of the ground and throws it in the back of her truck. And I'm right behind her going home. And I'm like, I put my high beams on. I'm like, I see a little bit of my lettering on there. I go, that's a Chris Barnett sign.
Hey, this person's stealing my sign. Now, that doesn't happen every day in which you actually catch the sign thief right there as you're driving around town. Okay.
Correct. I've caught other people in the primary stealing other candidate signs. And there were some of the homeless doing that. But this happens to be a person that was a former teacher, Deb Berg. She's also on the... She's an organizer with the John West recall booth. So I'm like, really? You're stealing my sign? So I confronted her. She said her name was Deb Berg. It's on my video. And I said, well, why are you doing this? I just saw you at the city, the county commissioners meeting this morning, and we were all talking about people shouldn't be stealing people's signs. And you were there. And she's caught stealing the sign. And I'm like, you can't steal it. And she just... tried to, you know, she was embarrassed. She got caught. And I said, look, I said, we don't do that type of stuff. You know, you need to put that back. So she didn't put it back. And I told her I was calling the police to press charges. And I said, this stuff cannot happen, Deb. I go, Deb Berg, I go, you were a teacher? I go, shame on you. You don't do this stuff. Come
on. Now the thing is, though, did the recall committee then go out and hire a homeless person to re-steal the sign? I just have to ask you, Chris. Is the sign still there?
It's still there. I just drove by it. Still there. And the John L. Scott real estate sign that was there from one of my friends. I told him, I said, hey, your sign is still there. But they took my sign, and then I made her put my sign out. So she purposely targeted me, and then going to her social media page, which has totally been removed now from what I understand, she had badgered me for months, and I don't even know the lady. So she doesn't like me. She doesn't like Mr. West. She doesn't like some of the other candidates. And I'm like, and you work at the recall booth? Shame on you. Now you're throwing me in there. And I go, This is ridiculous. It shows what kind of tactics they'll play.
All right. Now, Chris, you know what this means, though. You're going to have your campaign supporters invest in a bunch of game cams, and you have to put game cams all over, all over Southern Oregon.
And Apple AirTags. So honestly, we do have some of those deployed. So there is some bait out there. If people want to go ahead and be the next person on the TV or radio or whatever, go ahead, because I hate to say we have to do that, but it's gotten to that, Bill. It's painful. It's childish. Stop it.
Well, thanks for the report, Chris. And, of course, Chris Barnett, what's your website again?
VoteChrisBarnett.com.
Okay. People can contribute to the Replace the Sign Fund if they want to, I guess.
Yes, they can. We had a raccoon last night guarding one of my signs, and it's been funny. People are sending pictures of funny little memes of them in front of my signs acting like they're going to take it.
So all right. You got fun. It. All right, Chris. Hey, thanks for the update. I just can't believe it's like a student council in Joe County right now.
Absolutely. It's nonsense.
He said that Chris Barnett, he's a meanie. I'm going to tear down his sign and throw it in my pickup truck. All right.
Thanks,
Chris.
Bill, I appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Jeez. Okay. All right.
Stay updated on recreational opportunities all over our region.
ElectricOregon.com.
For whatever reason you're buying or selling gold right now, might I suggest you talk with the recognized experts. And it is pretty active right now in the gold and silver world. You want to talk with Jay Austin and Company, gold and silver buyers, Ashland and Grants Pass. Ashland, 1632 Ashland Street, 6th and G in downtown Grants Pass. Call 482-3715 if you need that appointment. But you can just drop by today at the Ashland store and get in there. Gold and silver still on a tear, even though they gave back a little bit. Right now, this is with a little bit down this morning, $2,650. Yeah, $2,650. We're really in this neighborhood in which $2,700 is soon going to be the new $2,400, which was the new $2,200 of a number of months ago. Because people are looking at the situation right now. They're looking at the U.S. budget, the attack of the BRICS, if you want to call it, the ultimate debt that is overhanging there. And people are thinking about, all right, I need some wealth preservation, not even necessarily a return on capital, but a return of capital. All right. And so physical gold and silver has done this for thousands of years and continues to do so. Just look at the current price, or maybe you're willing to sell right now. One way or the other, there are willing buyers and sellers right now at Jay Austin. Jay Austin in Ashland and Grants Pass, FortuneReserve.com.
Connection, opportunity, possibility. It's what we all want.
Southern Oregon's place to talk.
It's 8:55. Hey, we got getting ready to wrap up the weekend here, so we need another dad joke of the day. Dad joke of the day is sponsored by Two Dogs Fabricating. TwoDogsFab.com, by the way, on Bryan Way off Sage Road in Medford. And right now, they have a huge blowout on their, it's kind of like the season ending. The four remaining Delco trailers they have there, they got 7x14 dump trailers, a 7x20 equipment trailer, marked down, really, really great deals. And if you've heard about, yeah, I know, we have Marco from Fontana Roofing this particular time, who is contributing the joke over at TwoDogsFab.com. Have you heard about the joke about roofing? Never mind. It's over your head. There we go. Get your dad joke submitted over at TwoDogsFab.com, and maybe we'll use yours too, all right? 8:56 and change. Hey, you know, people still writing me. Late last hour, we were talking about this study saying that Oregon has the second worst drivers in the country, and this just did not make any common sense to me. And I'm kind of where Matt from Grants Pass was talking about. Yeah, we kind of have a casual and a passive driving style because we're a little more mellow. I think it's the West Coast sort of thing. If anything, I see a lot of passive aggression out on the roads trying to keep people from passing sometimes. I think we see some of that. Terry weighs in on this. She emailed me and said, Bill, I'm sorry, but that Forbes report was totally wrong. Having been in all 50 states and driven in 49 of them, I say Florida has the worst drivers, and Maine isn't that far behind. In Florida, drivers drive crazily and do pretty much whatever they want, but the craziest is that they'll make U-turns on the freeway. My cousin My cousin and wife lived in Florida for several years. His wife tends to be very vocal and visual when it comes to her reaction to bad drivers. My cousin laughingly told us that with all the craziness on Florida highways and her constant reactions, she was going to come home dead someday. Now, in Maine, if a car is making a left-hand turn on a two-lane road, when they stop to wait until it's safe to make the turn with their turn signal on, every car behind them turns their signal on also. Really? That's interesting. And once the car makes the turn, all the cars that were behind them turn their signals off. Can be very confusing. Having lived only on the West Coast and even with most of my family living in Washington, I do agree that Washington's crazy too. But their craziness tends to be speed more than anything. That's Terry in Yreka. Thanks, Terry. I appreciate that.